It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. We are losing an entire dimension for mental health care. And I mean that literally. It's always been a three-dimensional proposition. You go to an office somewhere, big comfy chairs for a therapist, maybe something a bit more medical for a psychiatrist. You show up and you are in the space with another person in 3D. Then COVID happened. Therapy went online. Psychiatry, especially for routine things like checkups for medication refills, that went online too. Patients showed up for more appointments since they didn't have to travel. Providers weren't bound by distance as much. And from what I've heard, a lot of therapists are now giving up their offices. They're planning to do distance only from now on. Welcome to the future. And it shouldn't surprise us. The reduction of dimensions has happened in other fields. You've seen a lot more movies than plays, right? You've watched more sports on TV than in person. The 3D experience is great sometimes, but it's complicated and it's expensive. It's easier to just watch TV. Well, things might be on your monitor now or your phone instead of the television, but that's just the new arrangement for mental health care. We're not going back. It's not a fad. It's a revolution. We called up Dr. Anthony Sosong. He's a child psychiatrist and an instructor at Harvard University. He's also chief medical director for behavioral health at Amwell, an online health platform. He's as expert as they come on the subject of telepsychiatry. Before I talked to Dr. Sosong, I watched a YouTube video of a talk that he gave about the future of telehealth dated January of 2020. He didn't know the storm that was soon to arrive. In the talk, he showed a slide from the cartoon The Jetsons.
1962, Elroy sees the doctor. This is a video visit. I mean, every bit as much as we're doing it today. So that prompted Kathleen Myers in her paper in the Journal of American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry said telemedicine has been right around the corner for 5 decades. So this was written about 5 years ago. It's getting close to 6 decades.
Dr. Sosong says the future arrived soon after that talk.
Telemedicine or virtual visits for behavioral health went from well under 10% of the visits to 80-90+%, and that happened overnight. And really since then, we haven't seen a huge fall in that number. So not only does it seem to be the new adjunct to treatment in a brick and mortar facility, but it may actually become the predominant modality for treatment in many ways.
How is it held up? Like with that much of an increase, that just seems like really potentially risky for things to just get crashy and horrible in any enterprise when you ramp up that quickly.
Yeah, you know, I think that there are a couple of aspects to that are, you know, really important. One is that, you know, you said the bugginess or the glitchiness or, you know, that I think that during COVID, with everyone shifting to a sort of virtual kind of interaction, there was, and I think still is, a certain amount of patience and understanding when things don't work the way that they're intended to work. And I think that actually allowed for a lot of folks to transition their practices to a virtual medium because there was that sense of, well, this is what needs to happen. It's the right thing to do for the patients, for the community, for my practice. And we're just going to have to work through the bugs. And so I think there was a certain amount of understanding that was present because of that need. But, you know, I think, you know, taking a step back, there's been an absolute shortage overall of behavioral health providers that's national, it's international, and on top of that, a regional misdistribution where, you know, some of the more densely populated urban areas tend to have more behavioral health providers in states like Alaska. You know, for child and adolescent psychiatry, for example, there can be one doctor for every 30,000 plus children in the population. And that's just a shocking number and a very, very huge difference in regional distribution. And telemedicine has always been thought of as a potential way to address that. And I think that it is. I think that we're seeing that. I think that, you know, we're addressing some of the regional misdistribution, but this is also a time of immense need when, you know, especially caregivers and essential workers are seeing three times the odds ratio for thinking about suicide in the last 30 days over the last year. So, you know, these kinds of issues are only getting to be more. And at the same time, you know, we are allowing this regional misdistribution to be rectified. And because of that, I think that the whole country is feeling a sense of strain on the network.
Yeah, so you're saying there's a bunch of factors going on here. We still have the shortage of care providers that, you know, especially with psychiatrists, that's been so frustrating for people for so long. So you're saying the psychiatrists are getting to more people and more people in the underserved areas, but there's more demand for them than ever.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that it's the kind of experience that's really being shared by the entire country and regardless of region at this point.
So I was talking with someone in the field of psychiatry on a video call, and the call was crashing a lot. Their mic stopped working. My mic stopped working. I think we were talking on a portal that was HIPAA compliant, so it wasn't as smooth as your average Zoom call. And if I was a patient in that scenario, how does that affect the quality of care itself? Like, I found myself not being able to have the conversation on the topic that I wanted to because I was so preoccupied with the tech. Like, how does that affect what they're getting out of what the patient is getting out of that appointment?
Great question. And, you know, it's an unfortunate experience that you had. And I think that you hinted at the HIPAA compliant platforms being potentially separate from other less secure consumer platforms. I don't think you have to make that choice anymore. I really think that increasingly you can have a secure, HIPAA compliant, clinically appropriate platform that works. And of course it needs to work in order to provide care. But I would compare it to the kinds of interruptions that one might have in a doctor's office. I mean, I'm sure you've had the experience of an assistant or a nurse walking in and handing the doctor some papers or the phone ringing or a pager going off. So I think people adapt. It's not ideal, but I think less and less, you know, we're seeing those interruptions really get in the way of the visits. And, you know, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier a little bit, which is I do think that there was that sort of that period of understanding. You know, things may not work quite as we hope, but they're getting better.
Yeah, but is there dissonance? You know, if I'm talking to my therapist who I'm used to sitting in a room with and seeing her across, you know, in the other chair, and now she is a two-dimensional face on a screen, is from a psychiatric perspective, does that make a difference, that kind of dissonance, that kind of dehumanization, or is everything mostly fine?
Well, so you get at a really interesting question, you know, which is what presence and what is presence, but what presence does to the therapeutic relationship. And I think that is something that we're learning more and more. We're learning in the working world, right? We're doing a lot of meetings and conversations that used to be in person. I mean, you know, people are doing happy hour
right
on video. And I think everybody understands that that's a very different experience, but in some ways can provide much of the same sense of presence that you would have in person. You know, I think we're moving towards a mixed paradigm where treatment really, the modality of treatment really follows from the treatment and what the needs are. Mm-hmm. You know, in New England here, every winter we have a big dump of snow, and everybody, you know, has to kind of contend with how they're going to get around in this inclement weather. And you know, that would be a time where a continuous treatment, an ongoing treatment in an office setting, could very well be supplemented by a telemedicine visit, and that could add to that sense of presence and sense of relationship.
Yeah, no. I as a Minnesotan, I feel you on that one. If COVID had never happened, a lot of people would still be driving to their psychiatrist appointments. You know, you got to get on the freeway, you find somewhere to park, you wait in the lobby, you got to wait for elevators, just to go into a room and tell someone how you're feeling. And I'm feeling like just we're kicking ourselves like, oh, this is so much easier, especially if it's something like a med refill kind of thing. Is this just the way we're going to do it now? Is telemedicine just a better way of doing a lot of psychiatry?
You know, I think that telemedicine is an incredible tool in the tool belt of doctors and therapists. And I don't think we're ever going to go back to where we were. I mean, in the scenario that you sort of described about going to a visit, and I would say sometimes you're parking on the freeway as well. Yeah. You know, you by the time you get to the office, if you're going into a therapy visit, how is it possible to not be focused on all of the inconveniences and the incidental things that happened just on the way to the office before you could even get back to where you were in a more reflective space at home? So in some ways, I think there may be some sort of fast forward that can happen within the session. But that said, you know, there are things that need to happen in an office. For example, you know, if a patient's on a medication that might have some effect on their musculoskeletal system, that there may need to be an in-person physical exam. And so with those things in mind, I think as people, both patients and providers, become more aware of the benefits and limitations of the different media, of the different ways to sort of have the encounter, whether synchronous or asynchronous, I think that it's going to increasingly be a part of a larger treatment plan.
Yeah, I mean, now that you mentioned that, I suppose there is no sort of perfect control situation where you're not carrying baggage into the room, and whether it's your kid going to school in the other room or having dealt with traffic on the way there, you know, there's no guarantee that the doctor is going to see a completely fresh and neutral patient regardless of the situation.
You know, and it's a great point. Of course, you know, that can all be grist for the mill, you know, and the way in which we react to the world and understand the world is sort of personality by definition. And that can come out and then can be apparent and be part of the therapy itself. It's not wasted time. It certainly allows for people to discuss the way in which they interact with frustrating situations. But you know, that 30 minute plus commute and the vertical commute up the elevator and or whatever it is to get to the therapy, you know, it can be very distracting. I will say, though, that just like, you know, there are inconveniences to getting into a room and there are certain circumstances that work better in in-person therapy than others, there are some things in telemedicine that should be avoided as well. I can't tell you the number of times I've had reports of patients doing a treatment or having an appointment from their car.
You'd think
that being in the car, you might be just sitting there in order to have some time away from the family or to have some privacy. And certainly that's understandable, but no, driving on the road while having an appointment. So, you know, if there are a couple of suggestions I would have, it's don't be driving when you're seeing the doctor.
You know, at least pull over. At the very least.
Pull over. Yeah, exactly. But you know, the state-based licensure requirements, particularly for medicine, make that interesting too. I mean, we've had circumstances where people are in a appointment and actually cross a state line, and so then we have to address whether or not, you know, the licensure of the provider actually allows for license for practice in the state. Anyway, it becomes very complicated, and so there are all of these questions that have to be contended with.
Yeah, which is exactly what a psychiatrist wants to deal with during an appointment.
That's right.
State licensure.
Yeah.
I want to touch on a little bit broader of a scope of online therapy, which is therapy apps, mental health apps, where there are a lot of options, but it's kind of the Wild West in terms of regulation and in terms of what you get. As a psychiatrist, how does the overall picture of the online experience in mental health make you feel right now?
So a lot of feelings, but I think mostly optimistic. I think that what I see is an attempt at every level to address an area of medicine that for many, many decades has been stigmatized and has been thought to be separate from overall wellness. And I'm really excited to see that there are attempts to address this in many ways. One in five U.S. adults experience mental illness every year. And as a child psychiatrist, I see children, adolescents, adults, and the focus on development is so key. 50% of all mental illness that persists into adulthood begins before age 14, and 75% by the time people are 24. During COVID, people 18 to 24 have been particularly hard hit by anxiety and depression and substance use and suicidal ideation. So, you know, for all these reasons, I'm just glad to have every opportunity out there to really engage with people who are in need or potentially moving towards the place where they're in need. That said, I think there are certain ways in which people can sort of find what's most helpful for them. I think really assessing, what am I feeling right now? How am I doing? How am I functioning? How is this impacting me, my family? And do I need something to help promote my current state of wellness or prevent me slipping into depression or anxiety? Or am I starting to have symptoms that are interfering? Millennials are so much less likely to have a PCP than any generation before. And I think we finally got it right.
It's like a family doctor, general practitioner.
Exactly. A primary care physician. Exactly. So we finally got it right where we actually had a lot of behavioral health services sort of hanging off of the encounter and the relationship with the primary doctor. And now, you know, we've moved to a dynamic where people are kind of looking for ways to self-service their own care, to sort of access ways of staying well, you know, seeking treatment when, you know, just-in-time treatment, you know, just as it's needed, and stay well, but not necessarily in the same model that we had before. So I think the more opportunities there are out there to seek help at all levels, the more likely people are to engage. And so I'm optimistic.
That's Dr. Tony Sassong from Harvard University and Amwell. So, okay, our mental health will live on the internet then. So how do you protect your safety, your privacy, your identity in a world like that? That's just ahead. There are a ton of mental health apps available online right now, thousands upon thousands. Some are overseen by doctors. Some are literally created by teenagers. It's hard to navigate and know what you're getting, and it's important to stay safe because this is your mental health that we're talking about. Chet Wisniewski knows more about online privacy and security than anyone I know. He lives it. Chet is the principal research scientist at the security firm Sophos. He writes the Naked Security blog there, and I asked him to take a hard look at a lot of the apps being offered. He started with Talkspace.
Well, looking into it, I mean, Talkspace is probably one of the most controversial, and I guess to some degree that always goes along with being the biggest. You've got the biggest target on your back, but there were certainly a lot of questionable business practices that may make you question how seriously they take following the rules. And there are accusations that they were involved in. Well, one of the founders said that they had a degree that they didn't actually have in psychology. They, you know, had some fake reviews they were encouraging employees to post allegedly about the application in order to boost its popularity. But those things are more business practices and specifically the privacy stuff. What I wanted to look at was kind of digging through the actual policies of how they're handling the information that they're entrusted with, because Talkspace is no different than all the apps we talk about today. They are a proxy for your communication with the therapist providing you services, right? So even if it says you can have a phone conversation with your therapist, you don't actually dial them on the phone. You dial into their system and the other person dials into their system. And therefore, they're always in the middle of any communication you have with the provider. And so all of the communication you have, whether that be video, audio, text messaging, is captured by the provider of the service, in this case, Talkspace.
And from what I know, if information is on the internet, there's a decent chance someone is going to try to get it. If the more personal, the better.
Yeah. And it really depends again on, you can dial your paranoia level to different levels depending. I mean, as somebody who's worked in privacy and security for over 25 years, I'm a little off the charts on the paranoia level generally, as far as like wanting to keep my information private. And you have to kind of remember that if you've got different types of people that may be interested in the information for different reasons, right? There's been a lot of health information theft on the internet related to insurance fraud that's being done by criminals who are just trying to make money by scamming insurance companies or exploiting policies. And that's a very different adversary, is a language we would use in our space. That's a very different person trying to acquire your information than maybe a government. If you're maybe you're an activist, or you're someone that's of interest to a spy agency, or maybe you're an immigrant from a country where there's somebody's interested in trying to exploit that information to hurt you. Mm-hmm. So when we're on the telephone with one another, that's incredibly easy for a government to get, but that's incredibly hard for a hacker to get, right? So there's different kind of threats that you have to consider somebody may try to perpetrate. The good news in all the apps that I looked at is at least the technical way they encrypt the communication between either the app and their servers on the internet or your telephone and the communication that they're doing looks to be pretty solid, right? And there's no gaping holes that look like somebody sitting on your Wi-Fi would suddenly be able to spy on your conversation. So that's good news.
So with a place like Talkspace, I'm sure there's copy on their website that says, "We take your privacy very seriously. It means a lot to us." Do we have anything that protects the user and protects even the therapist, I suppose, on the other end, beyond sort of vaguely worded assurances? Like if something fails in the security pipeline, does somebody get in trouble, I guess, is the question.
Well, theoretically, yes. I mean, under in the United States, that's all governed under the law known as HIPAA, which is designed to protect your health insurance and privacy with all your health information that's collected. And as more and more information is being digitally done, even traditional in-office therapy sessions, the records of that now are usually stored electronically in an electronic medical record system. So one way or another, your information gets stored on a computer, and that HIPAA is designed to protect that information. And there certainly are potentially stiff penalties for violating HIPAA.
Is Talkspace mandated to follow HIPAA, though, as a private company and not a provider themselves?
There's a lot of gray areas with these things. And so that's something I guess you'd need to ask an attorney. It certainly appears that they believe they're regulated by HIPAA. The privacy policies for Talkspace, BetterHelp, Larker, and some of the other ones all reference that any time that there's a thing in their privacy policy that is in violation of HIPAA, that HIPAA supersedes what's in their legal agreement. So they seem to imply that their attorneys believe they're regulated by HIPAA.
Let's move on to another name that I hear come up a lot, maybe even a little more favorably, and you can tell me if that's true, which is BetterHelp.
Yeah, BetterHelp's sort of the seeming giant that goes by many different disguises, so you can't always tell it's BetterHelp, as I discovered.
And what could be more reassuring than a giant in disguises?
Well, there's BetterHelp itself, which of course is the primary brand of the organization. They were recently acquired by a large investment group, which to me is always a concern when I'm looking at privacy, because these private equity firms and things like that often are making these acquisitions to extract every dollar they can from the information that the organization possesses. And of course, that information happens to be your mental health information. Mm-hmm. So that is a little bit of a warning flag to me. They also own the marriage counseling service known as Regain.us. And they also do business as teencounseling.com. So they've sort of split off their therapists that have specialties in certain areas and rebranded them. And it's unclear, if that's probably just, marketing stuff that they're doing. Although there was a lot of controversy with BetterHelp a couple years ago, and that they, again, they had some paid reviews with YouTube celebrities that had gone a little flat with people. There was a lot of accusations that they were having predatory pricing and how they were charging people's credit cards and this kind of stuff. So it's always good to have a makeover, right? We're not talking about Ma Bell. We're talking about Verizon. It's a completely different organization. So, there's a little bit of that there. Comparing it to Talkspace, one of the things that Talkspace does that makes some people uncomfortable. It looks like BetterHelp does not. That does give them, in my opinion, a bit of a privacy leg up, is sort of artificial intelligence analyzing the conversations between your therapist and yourself. So they Talkspace says they anonymize those conversations and then they process them to try to spot trends to see if there's concerns that they should have maybe with a particular therapist providing service. But the reality is most of what they're doing is analyzing it for marketing purposes to find new ways to market the service to people by analyzing your conversations with your therapist. And it does not look like BetterHelp does that. So if that's something that makes you uncomfortable, the idea that you know, robots in the sky are processing your private thoughts to try to find new ways to market a service, then BetterHelp might be a better option than Talkspace in that capacity.
Wait, so I just want to make sure I get this. So Talkspace either does or reserves the right to have a robot listen to your conversations with your therapist after your name is supposedly stripped from that conversation in order to do better marketing?
Well, that they reserve the right to do that, which suggests that that's exactly what they're doing. Obviously, we don't know what they're doing. They simply tell you in their policies what you're giving them permission to do.
Terms
and,
of service.
There's terms of service. Sometimes there's a terms of service. There's a privacy policy, and sometimes there's terms and conditions depending on the lawyers that wrote the agreements. And I had a great time yesterday reading all those.
Thank you for that, Chet.
Down to the detail to figure out what are these guys behind these things actually up to. And certainly Talkspace stood out from the crowd as saying, you know, they apply machine learning and artificial intelligence techniques to, quote, the information, which of course is defined very broadly in the privacy policy to include all of your private conversations with your therapist in order to enhance the service and find, improve its marketability and to provide better quality control to, you know, the users of the service. So what that means is up to you, but if they're including to improve the marketability of the product in that list of things, you can guarantee they wouldn't have put that there if they weren't.
I can't imagine going to a therapist back in the before times where you could be in a room with people and then have them say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just going to have this robot in the corner record everything. But I'll tell them not to remember your name, and then it'll help our marketing. That is, I mean, I suppose that's routine. I suppose that kind of thing happens all the time. But in terms of therapy, that's sort of a deep, soft layer that we're talking about.
Yeah, you need to, unfortunately, these services largely appear to be, the Uber of the therapy space, right? Their private contractors are the therapists. They're not hired by these companies. These companies are not liable for anything other than saying that they've done a background check, perhaps, or verified that they have a legal credential in their state, which is important. But the challenge being almost all of these new Uber-like services, the goal is to collect information en masse and analyze that information to provide a more efficient and effective marketing of the service to make it more profitable. And that's not something that would traditionally happen in therapy, right? Most therapists are either independent or they're maybe a small group working together. They don't have big data sets and they don't try to analyze those sessions to optimize their business. But that is exactly what these online services seem to be designed to do.
Yeah, I don't really mind that Amazon knows that I like to read memoirs and biographies, but my issues with my mom are kind of a different thing. Let's take a look at another one here, and the same lack of vowels that you so often find in online companies. This is an app called Larker with no E between the K and the R.
Yeah, there was a few odd things, but it looked to be the one that was probably exploiting the data collected the least, I would say, of the ones that I looked at yesterday.
That is the definition of the term damning with faint praise.
Well, one problem they had that is not true with them. So both BetterHelp and Talkspace and BetterHelp's other brands, Teen Counseling and Regain, one of the benefits of them being a proxy to the telephone calls is that it's exposing less information about the user to the therapist if they don't want to disclose it. Things like your phone number isn't known to the therapist, and that is a very important private piece of information. It's also an important piece of information if you're worried about, again, government or law enforcement kind of things, because your phone number these days can be translated to your exact location because we're all carrying a smartphone. Mm. So not having your phone number known is a nice privacy benefit to using a proxy by using an app. And Larker does disclose your phone number to the therapist. So if that's a concern for you, that might not be the service for you. But aside from that, it doesn't look like there wasn't any robots in the sky processing your conversations. So that was kind of nice. They referred a couple times in their privacy policy to a HIPAA policy that I could not find. So apparently they have a HIPAA policy, but it's a secret.
Just to protect everybody from reading it.
Yeah. And, you know, back to the ownership thing, I mentioned BetterHelp was recently acquired by a large investment group. Larker is founded by some previous Silicon Valley startup people, but not seemingly anything related to mental health. So I'm not quite sure how you kind of connect the dots there. But at least from a data collection standpoint, it didn't look like they're in it for the data. It really seemed to be much more about the service they're providing compared to Talkspace and BetterHelp. Certainly seemed to be really about the data.
Okay. Now, some people might be using these apps. Some people might be using some of the other 10,000 apps that are available out there. But a lot of people are probably just doing online therapy with the therapist who they used to see in the physical world before COVID. And how safe is that? What should we keep in mind if it's just like, oh, well, video call you and it'll be fine? Is that inherently safer?
Well, I mean, safety is a relative thing, right? Obviously, the sophistication of the security teams at these app companies, they're up on the latest stuff, presumably, right? Like, it's impossible without doing an audit for me to know for sure, but certainly based on the assessments I looked at, they all were quite sophisticated in how they're handling communication electronically to ensure that it's encrypted and protected between you and their service. And obviously, an individual therapist is unlikely to be a privacy and security expert. Hopefully, they're privacy experts to the standards that they need to for ethics reasons.
Right.
But they probably don't have the mastery of the computer and the things that they're using the same level as the IT experts that are hired by these services, right? So there's likely to be more small mistakes made. The question just becomes, is there a reason or is there someone actually, you know, trying to hurt you when you're having that one-on-one conversation, which seems to be, if you're looking at a service with a million users, you could certainly understand why hackers might target that service because they've got so much information to steal that could be so profitable in quantity, whereas your individual therapist is probably only treating 20 patients.
Yeah.
They're not likely a target either. So if they slip up, it's likely to be a slip up that's not exploited by anyone because there's not someone waiting there to take advantage of the mistake that they might make. So it's really kind of a balancing act a little bit. It's certainly something, you know, I compare to other types of security that I look at. You know, people go, well, should I be worried about the Wi-Fi at Starbucks? And I'm like, well, it certainly is insecure, I can tell you that. But there literally have to be a criminal at Starbucks willing to risk getting arrested to sit there and spy on you at Starbucks. And that seems pretty unlikely to me. Compared to, you know, stealing your password online and emptying your bank account, which is far more profitable and can be done from Moldova.
Right.
I would say the same thing is true when you're dealing with your individual therapist, even if their practices aren't great. There's probably not someone there necessarily trying to exploit it. I would actually, you know, have that conversation with your therapist to see just how savvy they are about technology. I was discussing it with my wife going, well, you know, I would ask them, you know, like, see if they're concerned about, am I in a safe place before we have this conversation, right? Am I somewhere where I should be able to talk freely and openly with you? And certainly, I think video calling services like Zoom and FaceTime and Signal and those things are not created for the security level to necessarily meet HIPAA requirements, but they are quite secure. And I would feel very comfortable personally having a conversation over those types of services with someone, as long as I was somewhere where it was appropriate to have that kind of conversation.
So then if you're meeting with your therapist who you knew before, you're just doing it on a Zoom or a Google Meet, something pedestrian like that, you're a small fish. You're not the one that they're going to go after in the same way that they might try to just get all the information that's on Talkspace, you know, these massive data breaches you often hear about. So the key is to be small and uninteresting.
Yeah, and the other key is about the recorded data more than the ephemeral data, right? So if we're having a conversation and that conversation is not being recorded, then there's nothing really to steal unless you're watching it in real time. It's gone. Once the conversation's over, it disappears. What you need to worry about more is text messages and email, which are both terribly insecure. And they're also easy for someone to access. Again, if you have someone in your life who may be threatening to harm you or in this kind of situation, you need to understand they may take your phone and like look at it, right? So if you've got text messages or emails that are easy to access on your device, that may be a risk to some people if they're in an abusive relationship, that kind of thing. Where that's another benefit of using an app, right? If I have to log into Talkspace and use my face print or my fingerprint or whatever to unlock the app in my phone, then anybody that just picks up my phone can't see my conversations with my therapist. And so if you're talking to a therapist in real life, outside of these services, an independent one, you probably want to avoid using SMS messages or emails. You would hope that if you're having a text conversation back and forth asynchronously with your therapist, they should be using some sort of a web service that you log into to send those messages back and forth, no different than you would log into Facebook Messenger in your web browser and type messages to your friends. You want something where you have to use a password to log in to unlock that conversation history so that you have the privacy that you desire.
So ultimately, if I'm somebody who wants to get some help, and it's great to seek the help, and I'm looking at the apps, I'm looking at Talkspace or BetterHelp, some of these others, I'm looking at just the practitioner who might be in my town who I already know. In general, as a consumer, what should I be keeping in mind as I look at all my options?
Well, like anything, you don't want to disclose more information than is required to get the treatment that you need. And so I don't quite understand, for example, why, I'm sure it's probably a legal thing. I'm probably giving people advice to break the law, but like I'm uncomfortable giving my real date of birth in many situations, unless it's entirely necessary because it's an important part of my identity. And I think to myself, if I tell my doctor I was born on the first of the month I was born on in the year I was born, isn't that enough? If I'm 18 days younger than I'm supposed to be, am I really in the wrong weight bracket? Or, you know, like that's an unimportant piece of information to be accurate in a lot of cases. So I look at things as, you know, more information you disclose, obviously, the more there is out there to be stolen. But none of these things terribly scared me. Some of the business practices around trying to find ways to make money off of analyzing this stuff, they creep me out. They're creepy. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they're dangerous. I would not discourage anyone from seeking treatment through any of these apps or from their therapist, especially with all the stress we're under right now. I think they're reasonably safe to use. But if those types of things like AI processing your data, tingle that spidey sense that you think something's a little off with that, then, you know, certainly going with an independent person is likely to cost you a little more, but will probably preserve more of your privacy.
I just know that if I talked with my therapist about how I need to get a new wallet and then went online and saw wallet ads all over the place, I would burn the internet down.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, even if they're not doing that, you'll see it and you'll think they're doing it anyway. Like it's right in your head now, right? Like it.
This guy loves wallets.
Well, and I mean, we talk about privacy, and yet we're sitting, half the people probably listening are sitting in a room where either Google or Alexa is sitting over their shoulder listening to everything they say. Right. You know, we have to remember how surveilled we are these days and take it with a measure of, you know, is this balance right for me? And people decided to put speakers in their bedrooms. So for those people, they're probably comfortable with the robots in the sky.
The convenience versus privacy transaction that we conduct all day, every day. Chet Wisniewski of the security firm Sophos. All right, we've heard from experts, and now let's hear from some of y'all. Let's hear from some of the preshies, listeners of Depresh Mode, sharing their own best practices just ahead.
We have wasted this world. Our magic put a storm in the sky that has rendered the surface of our planet uninhabitable. But beneath the surface, well, that's another story entirely. In a city built leagues below the apocalypse, survivors of the storm forge paths through a strange new world. Some seek salvation for their homeland above. Others seek to chart the vast undersea expanse outside the city's walls. And others still seek what else? Fortune and glory. Dive into the Aether Sea, the latest campaign from the Adventure Zone, every other Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The 2021 pin sale has begun. Thank you so much to everyone who participated in the Max Fun Drive. This is the last year for a while that we'll be doing pins for Max Fun Drive, and the fifth year that we'll be selling pins and donating all proceeds to charity. The past year proved what we already knew, that having access to the internet at home is a necessity for work, school, healthcare, and keeping in touch with family and friends. So the proceeds from this year's pin sale will go towards Everyone On, a nonprofit working to bridge the digital divide. We're grateful that with your support, we'll be able to help low-income folks gain access to affordable computers, internet services, and digital literacy programs. The sale will run until May 28th. Folks at the $10 monthly level and above will have access to all of the pins from the drive. That's 38 pins, one from every show on the network. We also have a special 2021 Max Fun Drive pin that all members can purchase. Go to MaximumFun.org/pinsale for more info. And to learn more about Everyone On and support them directly, you can go to EveryoneOn.org.
We wondered how some of you members of the Depression Mode community were doing with the new two-dimensional reality of therapy. Here's what some of you had to say.
I'm Becky Smith from Westland, Michigan. I started seeing both my therapist and psychiatrist in the middle of the pandemic due to chronic stress and grief. I've never actually seen either of them face-to-face because they've only been doing video visits with me so far. When I was working in the office, I would actually go to my car. I'd work through my lunch, leave the office early, and then run down to my car in the parking lot and actually do my appointment there. And then when we were done, I'd just drive home. Well, now that I'm home all more, I find a quiet room. It's usually my bedroom, so I can close the door. I grab a glass of water and some cough drops in case my throat gets dry. And some tissues, too, in case I'm having a rough day. Nobody bothers me for like an hour. It's actually really nice to be able to talk to my therapist without having to leave my house. I don't know what it's going to be like when we're finally face-to-face. We've built this level of comfort, and it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves when we're actually in person.
Hi, this is Angie from the beautiful Pacific Northwest. In the last year, I learned that it's much more acceptable to come to therapy in your pajamas when it's teletherapy in your bedroom closet. I also learned that when you've told your two teenage boys that you're going to be in therapy in your closet for the next hour, what you really should have said was, leave mom alone unless you're bleeding.
Hi, my name is Jason. I live in the suburbs of Minneapolis. I've worked in telemedicine for a few years now, so I might be a little biased. My wife and our two kids and I have all participated in some form of online mental health care over the past year and a half. I think it's a big hurdle to connect with someone in group or individual therapy online, and we've had varying degrees of satisfaction. As for tips, I think it's important to find a physical space to enter therapy so you aren't doing it at your desk. It's also good to make space in your day, especially for those of us working from home. I think taking time before a session to center yourself and prepare, and then taking time after to recollect and recover helps you maintain some sense of stability in your day.
Hi, my name is Liz. Some of the things that have changed for me significantly with the move to online therapy and a work from home context in the pandemic is that a number of things that I had to deal with in order to go to therapy as a regular client have kind of made me realize how much of a weight and how much of a burden they've been now that they've been kind of lifted off of me. For example, having to not plan my whole work day around walking and driving 30 minutes to my therapy appointment and factoring that into my work schedule makes it a lot easier to just keep my appointments when I can just clock out for an hour on Outlook and my coworkers are none the wiser. So it's just much more integrated into my workday now. And then the other big thing that I didn't think was a big thing at the time was not having to awkwardly run into anybody in the waiting room of my therapist's office. One of my former psychology professors comes to mind as somebody who I was not very happy to see as a you know, moving from the role of student to the role of patient was very uncomfortable. And those were things, again, that I just kind of dealt with, but it did not really seem like a big deal until they were lifted off of me as something I no longer had to deal with this. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Kathleen, and I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So therapy, okay. So I had only met my therapist a few times in person before the pandemic, so I was really nervous about doing teletherapy. What has really helped me is shutting myself off in my room with the door closed so my three-year-old doesn't barge in, well, most times, and really devoting that time to myself. I find that I'm actually enjoying teletherapy more because sometimes, you know, pre-pandemic, driving to my appointment and then having to park and deal with people in the street as I'm walking to her office makes me anxious. I do look forward to seeing my therapist in person again, though, especially when, you know, your teletherapy link decides it doesn't want to load your camera or microphone, so then you're kind of like out of luck. However, I have learned during this process that maybe I shouldn't shut the door all the way anymore in my bedroom because it's kind of hard to do internal family systems work when your freaking cat is crying to get out of the room. And then my other cat starts and pretty soon it turns into one of my ragey parts coming out because I'm trying to shut the damn cats up. And then I have to tell my therapist, no, no, the rage hasn't been present lately. It's just coming out now because my cats are being assholes.
Thanks, Becky, Angie, Jason, Elizabeth, and Kathleen for sending those in.
My name is Caitlin. I am in beautiful Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I actually talked with Caitlin for a little bit. You'll learn why in a minute.
I've really enjoyed being able to be comfortable in my own home and talk to my therapist in a comfortable space for me when we're talking about some really hard stuff. It's nice to be able to be in my own environment and, you know, have my cat around and I can have my little therapy animal. And it's been nice to not have to, I don't have to leave work to talk to my psychiatrist. It's easier access for me to my mental health care with the televisits. And I've actually chosen to not go back to in-person because I like it so much.
Have you run into any stumbles, anything that you tried that kind of blew up in your face?
Not really blew up in my face, but I actually tried to do, I was in what they call a partial hospitalization program. And that was done all over Zoom. And I feel like that would have been better to do in person just because it's kind of weird to have that level of therapy in your home. Cause it was like 8 hours a day on a Zoom call, sitting in a chair, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So your home was partially a hospital.
Hospital. Yep. Sure was.
Can I go upstairs and there'll be Jello for lunch, maybe?
Oh man, that would be awesome. Yeah, we had to make our own lunch. At least in the hospital, they make you lunch.
Right. Caitlin Ryan is one of three volunteers moderating a kind of depression mode offshoot. It's a Facebook group called Preshies. A lot of the group members are people who listen to the show, but it's not really about this podcast per se.
Just a place where you can go and talk about general mental health stuff, what you're dealing with, what you've accomplished, what, you know, what you're thinking about, any sort of difficulties that you're having in your life. So it's a bunch of really kind, caring people that really just want to be there and support you. And every once in a while, I like to post funny memes because everybody loves memes.
Does the semi-anonymous nature of it help a little bit? I mean, I know it's Facebook. You're supposed to use your regular name, but you're not standing there looking into somebody's flesh and blood eyes. Does that help?
Yeah, totally. I think so. I mean, I grew up on the internet. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm old enough to remember dial-up. I remember when we got the internet installed. I think for me, I'm a fairly introverted person in real life. So for me, it's nice to be able to have that online community. But it's I like the separation because you're not in a room full of people that you have to, like, you know, feel their energy. And you can respond in the time frame that you like.
And just, if you're listening on the podcast, when Caitlin was describing that moment of being in a room with other people, she demonstrated it by tensing up her shoulders. That's the feeling behind it.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's interested in joining the Preshies group and joining the community that you help oversee, What should they keep in mind? What are best practices? What's the best way for someone to join and get the most out of it? What would you tell them?
I think one fundamental thing that I hope that all people that join the group understand is that we are not your doctors. That's a big thing.
Yes.
It's more than okay, and it's welcome to ask for advice, and you're welcome to ask for these things, but don't take what people are saying as true and factual medical care, because, you know, maybe we have some doctors in the group, I don't know, but you need to build that relationship with your doctor and have an ongoing discussion with them about stuff. So it's important to keep that in mind, but also all you have to do is click the join button and agree to the community rules. That's all you got to do, and I will approve you, and you'll be set to go.
Caitlin Ryan, one of the moderators of the Preshies. It's on Facebook. Search it. I hang out there sometimes. It's full of good discussions, including one going on right now about how Preshies isn't all that great a name for a pretty great group. Hey, discussions are good. Next time on Depression Mode, finding a therapist who shares your cultural experiences is affirming. It's also efficient.
I've found that it's so important for so many of us to have a person of color that understands what I'm talking about when I'm talking about how difficult it is to do X, that I don't have to explain the race element of my life to, or have to be questioned about, well, are you sure it's race? Or are you sure? Like, no, I get what's happening here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So that's been really, really important.
Jarrett Hill from the podcast Fanti joins us. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It might help them. Also, something that matters a lot, hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The crisis text line is also free and always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Depression Mode is your show too. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We take requests. You can email us. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepressPod. The Preshies group, as discussed, is available on Facebook. Just search for Preshies. You'll find them. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I have notes and thoughts and discussions on all of our episodes there as they come out, plus some fun and silly stuff, too. It's free to subscribe. I'm on Twitter, at John Moe, all one word, same on Instagram. A group of giraffes is called a tower, which doesn't make sense, but is still redundant. Hello to you credit listeners. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Our theme song, Building Wings, is written and recorded by Rhett Miller. He is a rock star and a jukebox hero, got stars in his eyes.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
I'm Jack Probst from St. Louis, Missouri, and I'm here for you.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.